You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 505 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcina,
and we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, future home of the Supersonics.
Wow.
Home of the 1979 champion, NBA champion, Supersonics,
it's
and possibly
still
future
currently home of the Supersonics. Come on.
Fair, I suppose.
I'm from Ren, Washington, future home of the Supersonics, as it once was.
Oh, man. I don't know if I still have that t-shirt in storage or not. I know I still have the photo.
Literally, it said future home of the Supersonics.
And I think it just said Sonics, but yes, it definitely did say that back when the
Renton, the team wasn't so super.
Renton Event Center, I forget what they called it. The drawings were, you know, we went and toured the site. It was great. Didn't happen. But there is an arena now. Clem Fletcher Arena.
I'm also coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the soup.
Easy for you to say.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 60 champion Seattle Seahawks. I was driving on 405 this week, 405 North, and there was a car with a couple of big 49ers stickers on the back.
Oh,
and I was like, they are just about to drive by our giant Lombardi trophy. It must hurt every single time that happens. You love to see it. Good luck with Mike Evans, though.
Enjoy. I mean, they won the ESPN NFL Live offseason, like, free agency bracket they did. So the 49ers have that going for
huge,
them, which is nice.
Huge news. That definitely matters.
Put that on the side of the building.
Hello.
Near the electrical substation, which is probably not actually the cause of their injury issues. Anyways.
I guarantee you, there were so many people out there, if you looked at offseason grades from last year, that gave the Seahawks a negative offseason grade.
Oh,
I feel mean, like it would be the majority of them.
Look, I'm not going to say anything about people regretting grades. Like, I am literally the last person to talk.
That's why you give everything a B+.
Can't regret.
In hindsight, all grades are a B+.
No one. In not knowing which grades are going to work well in hindsight, it's safest to give everything a B+. What was famously the grade for the 2012 NFL draft for the Seahawks from Mel Kiper?
I thought that was an F also, right?
The Seahawks got an F. That is accurate. Yes.
Incredible.
They only drafted.
Who am I to say we shouldn't be grading things, though? Grade more things.
Please. Please do grade all the things. They only got two Hall of Famers out of that draft, right?
It's debatable. I do feel like Russ is like, he's debatable.
He's going to be a Hall of Famer.
Bobby Wagner's a lock, but
this too shall pass. There's a lot of this too in the case of Russell Wilson and the current baggage that his Hall of Fame candidacy holds. But we are not here to talk about Russell Wilson's Hall of Fame chances today. We are instead going to start with semi-emergency pod style with the report from ESPN Shams Charania on Monday morning that I woke up to, that the NBA will vote on going forward in the expansion process with Seattle and Las Vegas as the only two cities at the Board of Governors meetings to be held in New York later this month. So, you know, this is not in any way, I think, a surprise in the context of, you know, the momentum that we've seen building in the last month or two here, where, you know, the tone on expansion has changed really dramatically, really quickly. And, you know, starting with Adam Silver saying at the All-Star break that expansion, the future of expansion was likely to be decided this year. Since that moment, there have been a lot of signs pointing toward, you know, Silver feeling confident enough to take this to a vote. And there's going to be multiple steps, multiple votes in this process. But this is obviously a key one. And, you know, closer than we've gotten on expansion at any point since 2008 when the Sonics moved.
And so this vote, I guess, did this come as a surprise, the timing of this to you?
No, I mean, I didn't necessarily know that there would be a formal vote on this per se, but it did seem clear, you know, that they were going to inform the, you know, the owners, the governors who make up the board of, you know, what they've learned about expansion and get. Silver had indicated that there would be a step that in between them going out and talking to specific groups who wish to own teams in Seattle and Las Vegas. So again, even though Silver has been very careful to highlight Seattle and Vegas and say he does not want to get our hopes up as part of this process, saying it is just going to be those two cities is a key piece of news.
Yes.
And then I think the other piece of news that is in biggest piece of news that's in here is the potential timing of returning to play in the 2028-29 season, which is at this point as quickly as it could realistically happen.
And so this vote that's happening is particularly just saying we're only going to look at these two cities. The next step after that, after assuming this is approved, I guess, how often are things taken to a vote and not approved in a situation like this? Is there any precedent for that?
Well, I can think of something that got taken to a vote that wasn't improved, that being the Chris Hansen Group's purchase of the Seattle, I guess it was at that point, the relocation of the Sacramento Kings to Seattle was denied by the Board of Governors in 2013, quite famously. But it, you know, that's kind of a more formal decision. I do think there's, you know, still some degree of uncertainty about the actual vote on whether to award expansion franchises. But to go forward with the next step in the process, it seems unlikely that there would be enough dissent to prevent that from happening.
And then, so what is that next step after this?
So that's going out and, you know, taking, we don't know whether they'll specifically take bids, solicit bids, but at the very least, engaging groups in a more concrete way than they have at this point. And I think that's when you will likely see, you know, the Kraken for a long period of time have been very careful about, we're not going to get ahead of the commissioner. We're not going to get ahead of the commissioner. You know, we're ready when this happens, but we, you know, don't want to, you know, be too forward with things. I think that will give them the opportunity to be a lot more public with their interest and, you know, what that could mean for the return of the Sonics. But one of the things that Brian Windhorst said on NBA Today is that, you know, multiple groups are expected in both Vegas and Seattle. It would be, you know, look, there's not that many opportunities to purchase NBA teams. They are things that tend to escalate in value historically. One of the interesting questions that I think comes out of this that maybe we should get to now is, you know, well, it's interesting that this would be happening sort of simultaneous to the Allen Group trying to sell the Seahawks. And I think what's relevant there, I mean, I think what a lot of people think of is, whoa, you know, if the Seahawks go for, let's say, $10 billion, and, you know, the Shams in the article said $7 to $10 million, $10 billion. Yeah, not million.
If 7 to 10 million, we got it. We're gonna do it.
I don't think we do have it, but we can
come up with $7 to $10 million. Come on.
We could find a group. I think what people are thinking is like, whoa, that's a lot of money between those two things. And I think what they actually should be thinking about is, well, there's not going to be only one group trying to buy the Seattle Seahawks. There's going to be a lot of different people trying to buy the Seattle Seahawks. And some of them are not going to buy the Seahawks. And this is going to be a possibility, opportunity for them to pivot.
Interesting. Okay, so you think a team, an ownership group who's trying to buy the Seahawks might strike out in that endeavor, might be more incentivized to try to bring expansion to Seattle.
I mean, I don't know whether that's specifically the case or not, but what I would say is, like, the fact that it's two teams on the market at the same time, I do not think it's going to work against the bidding for the Sonics in any sense.
To me, they're kind of totally unrelated. I don't even really see them.
I don't think they're totally unrelated, because there's just not that many people in the world who can afford to front a group like that.
And but again, there are two. You know,
there are more than two.
Yeah, that's the answer. And there are more than two who also are interested in owning teams in Seattle. I do think the bidders are going to be at least possibly slightly different. I mean, the obvious answer is the Kraken ownership group, right? For the NBA team, they have the inside track, I would assume, on this. They own the arena. They operate the arena, right? So I do think that's going to be kind of like,
and they have been planning for this. I mean, I wrote about it, you know, when we wrote about expansion back in September 2024, when it felt like things were, you know, more imminent than they subsequently became for the next 18 months or so. And now we've gotten, you know, to where we expected we were going to get to in that piece. And, you know, the Kraken have started sort of laying the groundwork in terms, you know, the foundation of, you know, having an umbrella organization that oversees both, the Kraken and potentially the Sonics, in the same way that the Allen Group has Vulcan Sports over both the Seahawks and the Portland Trailblazers.
Which there hasn't been any conversation around that group and the Seahawks, as far as we've seen, or much of a conversation, right?
No, I don't think that's...
So, to me, that's kind of not a concern. But I guess, how much should we be getting our hopes up at this point?
I mean, I never want to tell people how much they should get their hopes up, because that's an individual matter, and the pessimist is always either right or pleasantly surprised. I would say that, again, the NBA does not... The NBA moves deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Silver moves deliberately. They would not be continuing with this process if they were not optimistic about their chances of it moving to fruition with expansion teams.
Okay. And now we have a timeline on it too. And the timeline is not that long for now. I mean, 2028, and I'm looking at the calendar and it says 2026 right now.
Yeah.
2 years after all we've been through just doesn't seem like that much time.
I mean, we're coming up on 18 since the last Sonics game at Key Arena. So yeah. Yeah. Two is not that hard compared to that.
Was there any other information that happened today that was new or anything to pay attention to as of now that stood out to you?
I think those were the important factors. I mean, I think the other things is, like Sean's mentions in the article, I believe the possibility of, a team moving to the East, that sort of thing. These, again, are the logistical conversations you're having if you're operating under the assumption that this is going to happen.
Okay. I shouldn't, though, because I was looking at it and I was like, this is the day where I say, we did it, boys, right?
No, okay. No, that's not it. Not until the team is awarded.
Okay, the moment the team is awarded, then I could do the speech about basketball being back in Seattle.
Yeah.
Outside of the UW Women, of course.
Storm, come on.
Okay, fine, the Storm too.
Winter basketball. Winter basketball aside for the UW Women being back.
But about basketball being back in Seattle, the history, the legacy, every alley-oop, the teams that we saw that we grew up with that made us like sports to begin with. Stop talking about that right now. That is not worth thinking about at the moment.
That would be a bit premature to me.
Okay.
So we're not quite there. We're on the right track. We're not quite there yet.
It's always about ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton to dampen the hopes just slightly.
I feel like there's been
times you gave the enthusiasm a B+.
I feel like there's been times in the process where I've added enthusiasm.
Okay. I will not.
I have regressed my opinion to the mean throughout the process. I think some people said it's over, last July when I was there in the room.
I mean, I felt like it was over. Did it not feel that way?
Press conference. It didn't feel like it was over, but I was definitely I was pretty stunned by the negativity in the tone. I mean, it's a fascinating contrast because it's going to be the Pacific Northwest Board of Governors meeting, because the other thing that is going on the board related to Vulcan Sports is the Blazers sale to Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon is going to be voted for approval at that Board of Governors. And it's a pretty dramatic contrast, again, from the tone last July in Vegas, because one of the things that Silver said in the press conference that really sparked interest was mentioning at that point that the Blazers needed a new arena. And lo and behold, now they have gone to the legislature, and it appears the Oregon legislature, and it appears to have successfully secured funding for, substantial renovations to the Moda Center that will keep the team there long term. So
it's a perfect arena.
It's not a perfect arena, but it is not an arena that you need to start fresh from. So
I freaking love the Moda Center.
Good news on all fronts from the Pacific Northwest, I think, at the Board of Governors meeting later this month. So
okay, that's where we'll get to, and we're not even going to do the even if they approve this next vote, right? Then we can't get too excited yet. The other thing is, it's funny, like back in the day, it might have been like start paying attention to prospects now, but like all the people we'd be looking at as far as like that first draft, they're like 16 years old, 15 years old at the moment.
I mean, I don't think that's necessarily with the whatever pick they would give them in the lottery. I mean, yes, but with the second round picks, like it could legitimately be players who are starting in college basketball right now, given the state of NIL and the number of players who are staying multiple years now. So
okay.
I don't know if I've got specific names for you to to start
watch
watching
for multiple years.
For the 2028 second round, but yeah.
Okay, I will remain moderately optimistic about the entire situation. But what year is J.J. Crawford, by the way? Does this timing work out perfectly? He's a freshman right now?
He's well after that. His senior year of high school will be in 2029.
Wow. Okay. Because the team's going to be pretty bad for a couple of years. So that's what we should be doing, is watching J.J. Crawford.
Okay. Yeah, that's a long ways out.
We've got high schooler to pay attention to.
Tyron Stokes too early, I guess.
No, way too early for Tyron Stokes. I will remain moderately optimistic, though, about this. I will not say this is the time that we really should start getting excited about basketball in Seattle. But this is another important piece in the roadmap to expansion in Seattle. And I did feel like, you know, there were conversations about other cities. It has felt like Seattle and Vegas were the cities. This is what it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way that someone really could have bumped out Seattle and Vegas is if there was the expectation of relocation to go along with the expansion to some degree. And
it seems like that's probably not going to happen.
Silver, you know, dismissed that idea at the All-Star game at his press conference.
We might have to rescind Alex Rodriguez's 25% Seattle Sports Figure of the Year.
What about for the time that I sat in the green room with him before the Hoop Collective Live podcast in Vegas?
That's worth 25%. Wait, he was on the Hoop Collective Live podcast in Vegas?
He was on it before me. I was the headliner.
Alex Rodriguez was?
Yeah.
That was one that I didn't book?
It just happened last July. It was 3 days before this press conference we're talking about.
They had Alex Rodriguez last July?
Yeah.
How did he know that you were
in Seattle? I talked about it on the podcast.
Did he know that? How much did we talk? I don't remember this specifically. Did you tell him that you were from Seattle?
I did not bring it up, as a matter of fact.
Why did you bring it up? You thought that would have been embarrassing to be like, hey, A-Rod, I was there in 95 at the slide?
There could have been an appropriate time for it, but there was not. So
okay,
it's all fine.
Did A-Rod have handlers?
There was many people in the room. Because it wasn't just him. It was also Mark Lowry, the other co-owner of the Timberwolves.
Got it. Okay.
They had a whole team, PR team.
That's why A-Rod was only 25%.
The Timberwolves are happily staying in Minnesota.
I want the Timberwolves to stay in Minnesota.
Yeah.
In Minneapolis. Okay. This is exciting news, but not the most exciting news. We will remain optimistic, but this is an important step in the path to basketball returning to Seattle.
B plus all around. All right, well, let's get into a regularly scheduled podcast, starting with our toast this week. A congrats to UW's Hannah Moll, who jumped 15 feet, 9.75 inches, 4.75 inches than the meet record set last year to win the pole vault at the NCAA Indoor Track and Field Championships last Saturday in Fayetteville, Arkansas. It's Hannah's third career NCAA title. Her twin sister, Amanda, is sitting out this indoor season, was in Seattle on Friday to accept the Sports Star of the Year award that the two sisters shared.
Wow.
So a big weekend for the Mole sisters.
There we go. Is she the greatest track and field athlete in UW history?
I think so, yeah. I mean, you could talk about the 400 meter crew, I guess, or the 1500 meter crew, I guess, the metric mile. But I think so. Three career NCAA titles already ties the UW track and field record.
I mean, it's complicated to compare these two things, but it's sort of like, is Hannah Moll better than Steve Entman? You know, it's one of those things, like, is she the greatest athlete in University of Washington history? Kelsey Plum, I suppose, could be up there too.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's got to be ahead of them. I mean, Kelsey Plum was the all-time leading scorer in women's basketball history, but I don't know if there was a credit when she graduated. Obviously, she has subsequently been passed by Caitlin Clark, but I don't think there was a credible argument that she was, like, the greatest, because it's, you know, scoring is not the only measure of performance in basketball. Whereas in track and field, how high you in the pole vault, how high you jump is pretty much the only measure.
The only way to judge it. No vibe score.
It's not like ice skating, figure skating. They do not grade on artistic achievement. Let's see. Who previously had three national titles?
The
Oh, Scott.
crew teams overall, but like an individual rower, a little bit more skeptical about.
Okay, so winningest woman in track history, but there is Scott Nielsen won seven national championships in the weight and hammer throws, which is quite
Really?
impressive.
Scott Nielsen.
Yeah. Well,
That's
you
the
never
greatest
really
UW
talk about
athlete
Scott
ever.
Nielsen on the UW Mount Rushmore, but that's
What
what the
years was
Pelton
this?
cast is doing for you. I'm looking this up. It looks like a long time ago.
I'm sure it was a long time. We probably would have toasted to him if it weren't.
His greatest achievement was a gold medal at the 1979 Pan Am Games. Was
Okay.
also a silver medalist at the Commonwealth Games in 1978. He's a Canadian, but went to UW.
Was he ever in
Was
the Olympics? We're okay with
inducted.
that. It's okay. He could go to UW even if he's a Canadian. We like James Paxton.
just taking note of it. I wasn't
Josh
saying it
Naylor.
wasn't allowed. I
It doesn't
mean,
disqualify him.
Daniel Lorry is Canadian too.
UW isn't the World Baseball Classic.
I don't actually. I think that would seem to encourage people who weren't actually participating in the country they're born in. But that's a different segment of this podcast. He did not be he missed out on the Olympics because of the 1980 boycott.
Oh, you were wrong, Scott Nielsen. Poor American.
He would not have beaten the Soviet performance in the Olympics in Moscow. But
You
then,
don't know that. He didn't
well.
get to throw.
Well, we know that his actual throw, there was a competing event for the athletes who were boycotted called the Liberty Bell Classic, held
Wow.
in Philadelphia.
The America did their own alternative halftime show to the Olympics?
They did, yes.
Wow.
Probably got better ratings.
But it didn't beat the Soviet throws.
Did not. There you
Where
go.
would he have ranked?
That's going to require a lot of research.
1980s Olympic style.
He threw 72.6 meters. The gold medalist from the Soviet Union was at 81.8 meters.
Damn.
So, and that being that time, you only had the one chance, as we learned
Oh.
from the Iron Claw. So. There you go. Scott Nielsen inducted into the Collegiate Track and Field Collegiate Athlete Hall of Fame last year. We should have toasted to it. I
There we
was
go.
unaware of this information. So a retroactive toast to Scott Nielsen.
Toast to Hannibal and a retroactive toast to Scott Nielsen. That's what we're here for. I'm honestly so upset about the World Baseball Classic outcome that the idea, like we did the pregame, we podcasted about expansion to Seattle. I was feeling good. And I will tell you, no amount of Supersonics return can
Oh,
help
come on.
overcome the pain that I feel about Italy losing the World Baseball Classic when they were up to nothing. I will tell you the confidence that I had. That's the thing is, I always think about this when I'm like, I'm a bad person, of course, but like I always want the games to be close. And to me, the way that I feel about Italy in the World Baseball Classic is like, I want them to win by 50 runs. You know what I mean? I don't need it to be
This is the
exciting.
one event you don't want it to be close.
I will
You're like
tell
Super
you,
Bowl, could take or leave it.
I think I felt it emotionally
Oh,
on
wow.
about Italy in the World Baseball Classic. I was on the phone. I took a work call in the seventh inning when
So
Venezuela
you were the
scored all their
reason
runs.
for it.
Well, it was already starting to happen as
Okay.
I like took the call, and I'm like talking very normally and dying on the inside
That's
as
the
it's
best.
happening. So it was a devastating moment, and I was just like, what's even the point of podcasting about Seattle sports on our Seattle Sports and Italian National Sports podcast?
Some Italian national sports.
A
We
few Italian national sports.
very rarely talk about the pole vault.
If there were an Italian pole vaulter who went to UW, then we would talk
Oh,
about that person.
100%. I mean, the game that this fully reminded me of, conveniently, it was one of the most recent baseball games I've watched, but was game seven of the ALCS. The Mariners led by 2 runs in that case, but in the same case, you're taking the lead into the seventh inning and counting the outs away, and
No
then
shit,
a
it reminded
three
you of
spot.
that. It reminded all of us of that.
Okay.
All of the people who overlap of Mariners and Italian baseball fans, they remind all of this. And I will tell you that we were driving to baseball during the last out. So I didn't, and it like my stream glitched. So count I think was 2-2 or 3-2 and Antonacci was up. Antonacci. Also, we had a great running joke about what Italian city all the players were from, like Cleveland, Ohio. it was a really good bit.
You can at least say Parma.
I will say East Orange, New Jersey. that's where Tom Verducci is from. But I do this every time instinctively when I say their names.
I did have a thought. I feel like they should have had Rick Riz broadcasting these games. Like they should have had national broadcasters as well.
Rich Waltz, though, come on, blast from the past on the broadcast.
Mean, you hear him every once in a while in college basketball games. I mean, you don't, maybe. I do every once in a while. So I've been hearing Rich Waltz. But yes, it was very 90s Mariners coded.
Anyway, there was a certain pain that I was feeling during that. What I was thinking was, I was like, if Antonacci just gets on, Canzone is tying this game. The belief that I had in Dominic Canzone, and I will say, it was the same belief that I felt about Dominic Canzone way back to, I want to say, the AL Division Series, right? Because Canzone was the one who came in.
Got pinch hit for.
And then got pinch hit for. Every time Dominic Canzone is up in an important situation, I am 100% convinced that from the fine Italian city of Cleveland, Ohio, Dominic Canzone will get the job done. My faith in Italian baseball players, either on the Italian national team or on the Seattle Mariners, is 100%.
Yeah, and it's irrational either way. It was a 3-1 count to Antonacci, and then two back-to-back swinging strikes to end the game. I mean, what really made it seem like Game 7 of the ALCS is how meekly Italy went down after they gave
it
up
really
the three
did.
Runs.
No, they gave up those runs, and Francisco Cervelli, he was like, calm down. You could see him just being like, right, they showed him. He was like, calm down, everybody. And I was like, these motherfuckers lost this game. I was like, you could see just the air come out of them that inning. And it felt like...
With the crowd, the way it was going nuts. You couldn't hear this because you were on a work call, but...
No, I saw them. They kept showing them, and I was like, ah!
They didn't start showing Altuve until the 8th. You know it. You know where it really went all went south.
When was that?
When they showed Gianni Infantino.
Wait, who's Gianni Infantino?
The head of FIFA.
Oh no! See, we needed more Pope. If they would have had the kid dressed as the Pope, they would have won.
But Italy did not have a base runner after that and struck out. Let's see.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. The 5 of the 9 outs, the final 3 innings were strikeouts.
It all checks out.
It escalated quickly, or it de-escalated quickly, one way or the other.
Ugh, that's fine. I'm happy for Eugenio Suarez.
Oh, I'm very quickly pivoting to
Venezuela.
Becoming a Venezuela fan for the final.
No, I agree. I
Pizarro,
agree.
Gino. By the way, I am like I was fully prepared to complain about this on behalf of the Italian team, so I will on behalf of the Venezuela team now. Like, how is it fair that the U.S. gets an off day between their semifinal and the final, and these teams have to just play back to back? That's
bullshit.
It's
baseball. I don't know. I will get angry about it. It's bullshit. This is unfair practices. The U.S.
It was
lined up this way. If the U.S. would have won their group,
good point. Yes.
Then they would
Italy
have played
in
back
the
to
U.S.
back.
Spot.
Wow. Yes,
it was actually fixed for Japan.
I mean,
Japan
look,
just
Italy could have. If Italy would have done their job, this is the real issue. A true Italian team playing Italian baseball. This is how you know it's players a lot who are from America would have found a way to draw against Mexico. I'm just saying it. They would have
to finish second intentionally.
To finish, and also that's just what we do.
I mean, there would have been a lot of time wasting. I saw that joke on Blue Sky.
If they find a way to lose that game to Mexico by a run, we don't have to worry about any of the stories around the stupid American baseball team.
Wow.
Or Antonacci, if he makes that play, I'm just like, you're so close. I can't blame him. It was a tough play, right? The throw across the infield against
there was no chance of him making it.
Ugh. I thought maybe you could get that out at second on that play.
Yeah, I don't think so. John Smoltz consulted his vibes and decided he couldn't have. So,
okay, what is Jerry DePoto going to have to do to get Sam Antonacci onto the Mariners?
You, by the way, feel much more strongly about Antonacci's World Baseball Classic run than I do, based on the fact that he hit 105.
He really was present for the team. Also, you know what's not fair? We were without Kyle Teal in this game. So the Kyle Teal injury, nobody brings that up. The very, very important fellow White Sox, you know, fellow Southsider there with Sam Antonacci.
And with the Pope.
And the Pope, of course. If Kyle Teal is out there, Italy is winning every single game in this World Baseball Classic.
I mean, the thing that really stands, they almost won every game.
It's a young team. Young team, by the way. Set up very nicely for 2030.
2029. It's every 3 years.
Okay, it's every 3 years.
But Luca's going to have to get going sooner than you
what
realize.
What things are every 3 years?
Just this.
Okay. Who went into the lab and determined that? You either do it every 2 years or every 4 years. Three is not a number it can be.
I mean, it is by definition a number that it can be because it is three.
How horrible is it to go into? I love Sam Antonacci. Is that like rookie ball? Like he is not playing like high level baseball outside of the World Baseball Classic, and he's leading off for the team that was up in the semis in the seventh inning.
It's pretty wild stuff.
The World Baseball Classic rules. It's bullshit that we have to go from this to regular season baseball.
Not even, we don't even have to. We have to go from this to spring training baseball.
Yeah,
but
like
yes,
literally
then,
a couple of weeks of spring training.
Yeah, I mean,
baseball.
John Smoltz sort of made this point on the broadcast, and I think it's correct that, like, man, what a come down when you go back to your team.
Oh, like, yeah.
You're like, I was this close to winning a championship, and now I have to go through a whole regular season before I can even have a chance to get in meaningful games like this.
Yeah, no, it sucks. I think maybe baseball, instead of just doing a regular season, just tournaments. Do it like children. Let's do a tournament every weekend. How much fun would that be?
Baseball F1 style? There might be something there. Although, you mentioned earlier.
I like that
offline,
these are the polar opposites. It's either giant slog of a season where literally 3 months you could play kind of bad and all of a sudden get good in August and still make the playoffs and still win a World Series, weekend matters.
Might be good if you have Julio Rodriguez as your star player. You mentioned offline that you were surprised there wasn't a more significant American pro softball league. And I mean, that is the way that AU pro softball works, is it's basically like a tournament every weekend. So maybe there is something to this.
I it just hasn't garnered the attention yet, the tournament every weekend. Like, are there teams from specific places?
I mean, the other thing we have to look out for the Italy national team. No, obviously it's going to be a little more complicated.
The same probably in 2029.
Probably not going to have the same number of MLB players if they do qualify. But baseball is back in the Olympics in 2028 in LA. So.
Oh, with pro players.
No, I don't think it probably will be with MLB players. I would imagine it's probably minor leaguers.
Well, that's great because the entire Italian team is made up of minor leaguers. Good news.
How dare you say that about Dom Cancone?
He's like
best reporting.
One of the most experienced players on the team. And it's just like, yeah, he'll platoon.
Yeah, we called him up in May last year, and now he's probably going to be on the roster for good.
But like, Cantone has significant MLB experience.
He's pinch hit in playoff games, to your point.
Sort of.
I mean, technically pinch hit. No, he started other games. So, Italy still has to qualify. I don't know when that qualification is actually happening. Yeah. The teams from the Americas, besides the United States, qualified through the World Baseball Classic. The rest have to go through the 2027 WBSC Premier 12. So.
Sure was a lot of words. Okay. Okay. So how would you say, so it's funny, like we had this conversation also, because I kept, there was one broadcaster who was pronouncing Calianone's name right. That's how you'd pronounce his name, right? Jack Calianone?
Yes.
It is kind of funny when you see the American version of it where it's like Caglione. And you're like,
it's not really that close. I mean, it occurred to
Sure.
me that you often pronounce, I think, tend to pronounce our Italian name somewhat incorrectly. I'm not nearly as notably differently, but
Carcino?
there's a lot of Carasino often. I guess that's more a mom thing.
Carasino?
Yeah.
I'm almost always Tristan Carasino.
Okay.
Our Italian name. That's just my name.
I mean, it is my name as well. Or shared name, fine.
What do you mean? You think Carasino is the Americanized version of it?
Yes.
Okay, and Carasino? Matteo was like, he was like, why are there so many Italian Americans in New York? And I was like, are you familiar with Ellis Island? And he was like, what about it? And I was like, we lost an R and an S there, young
I mean,
man.
it is true. Yes. I think
No
many others
idea what
had
I was
worse
talking about.
experiences in that regard. My main takeaway is, like, before the past 2 weeks, I had no feelings about Vinny Pasquantino whatsoever,
You didn't?
and now I will die for Pasquatch.
You didn't have feelings about the Pasquatch beforehand?
I didn't even know that his nickname was the
Wow. You
Pasquatch.
need to brush up
So,
on your Italian baseball players,
I
sir.
think I did. You see on the Discord there was the tripod link to Italian American catchers.
I mean, it's just a thing. It's actually
Especially
disappointing that Luca doesn't catch. He's built to be a manager too. Like his future life is we always, I'm like, the most dangerous thing about him playing baseball is I'm like, I just don't want you to be coaching baseball in the future. It would be fine if you coach baseball after having a long professional baseball career. But like, I'm like, to me, like, you have good grades, go do something else, not in the field of baseball if you're not making it. But he is set up as a human being to coach people playing baseball. Is he not?
I mean,
He's got
he. How
all of
old?
your qualities while also being personable.
Personable? What do you mean? Well, because also being good at sports is what you
Yes,
meant.
that too, sure.
He has some credibility when he says the things in a way that I do not. How old was he when he intentionally dropped the pop-up or whatever, or the
That was
line
a
drive?
nine for a double play, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah,
That
no,
was
just.
pretty advanced. Don't think most 9-year-olds are making that move. So, anything else on the World Baseball Classic?
Ugh. Just in pain over here.
Spring training is certainly happening.
Oh,
Games
sure.
are being
Spring training's
played.
happening. Great.
Randy Rosarena is there.
Regular season baseball. Can't wait. Didn't the last time we go into a like lockout after the World Baseball Classic? Is that right?
Boy, what year was no? Because the delayed season was 2022 when the Mariners made their return to the playoffs. 2023, you'll recall, was the original no-holes season.
There we go. I mean, I was freaking
I mean, I did not watch any World Baseball Classic the last time around. This is my first
You
real
didn't
World Baseball
watch
Classic.
like the last game, Japan, the US?
I mean, I don't know. I might have watched the
It was
final inning when
Shohei versus
Shohei came up.
Trout for the last out.
Yeah, I'm aware that it occurred. I probably watched that inning, but
I
it was
was
not the same as I watched start to finish on this game.
I will say the previous World Baseball Classic, this one I was like pretty locked in on pretty early on. That one I was like, I'm not gonna watch this stupid bullshit. You know what I mean? And then by the end, I was like, wait, the World Baseball Classic rules? A bold take about it is that the World Baseball Classic is actually bad because it makes the rest of the baseball season boring.
It reveals how meaningless the rest of the baseball season is. But sometimes there is joy in the meaninglessness, in the ordinary time, as friend of the pod Brian Windhorst
Baseball.
would note. There's joy in
Well,
the meaninglessness. No, because
Bridhorst said it because of the NBA regular season, like
he did, yes.
the NBA November through
He
May.
said it, and then Bam Adebayo scored 83 points a day later, so or 2 days later. So, look.
Which was great for what? The chatter debating online takes.
You don't have to participate in the discourse. You could
I
just
will
watch the
say
game.
the Bam Adebayo 83-point game was maybe the greatest thing that ever happened to NBA sports media.
Think the greatest thing that ever happened? Not LeBron going to Miami?
I mean, that's something. But I'm telling you, LeBron went to Miami when a bunch of other stuff was going on, right? Bam Adebayo resurrected the month of March for NBA basketball takes. People were trying to get off takes about Jason Tatum. They were doing whatever they could, being like, oh, Luka's not fun to watch. And it's just like, dog, no one cares. No one cares about what is happening right now. And bam, literally bam, right there. 83 points from Bam Adebayo. The takes are going to be hot about this, not just for right now, not just for this week, for years about Bam Adebayo scoring 83 points. It was like when Kobe did it. Kobe did it at the exact right time, right?
I don't think it was a
Sunday night in the dead of January.
We're right after the championship games.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, the NBA was not going to get any love any otherwise, but it wasn't as dead of a period in the sports calendar. So.
No, it was an all-time great sports media moment that happened. And just having it be Bam Adebayo. If it would have been somebody a little bit better, the takes wouldn't have been quite as good.
No.
He's the exact perfect player for to have done it.
Here's my week later takeaway. It actually was the best thing that could happen for Kobe Bryant's legacy, for his record to be surpassed in this manner. It made people like think more of Kobe Bryant's 81.
I'm not sure if I buy that.
You don't buy that?
No.
Because of the drawing the contrast between both the way that Kobe scored the points.
Did Kobe score the points better than Bam Adebayo? There were a lot less free throws, or
it was in a close game against a team that was not good, but was not like hopelessly trying to be bad.
Okay.
And there was no intentionally fouling by the Lakers. So Kobe Bryant has the all-time record for most points scored in a game where a team with a large lead is not intentionally fouling to get a player more points, as the Philadelphia Warriors also did in Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game.
Interesting. Okay, so
that rarely came up in
the
takes.
The Wilt one. Well, it's so long ago that, and he's Wilt. Like, there's something about your name carrying weight that helps it, and an even number. That was
the even number is the beauty of the whole thing. Yeah, if he had scored 102 points, it would not mean nearly as much, and definitely if he was had scored 98, it would.
Do you think that this Bam 83 means that players now are going to try to get like extreme amount of points?
I do think so. It's also very hard to score 83 points in an NBA game, as it turns out, because there was like a sense of like, oh man, you know, just watch out. What's going to happen, you know, in the next game? Like, obviously, you know, but nobody, I don't know what's the most points that's been scored since Bam scored 83. That's a good question. But the number is like it's definitely less than 60. I don't know if anyone's even scored 50 in the past week.
I mean, I remember when 50 was a lot of points.
I mean, it still is a lot of points.
I was going to say, is that not true anymore? I feel like I probably saw like a couple of 50-point games ever.
I remember Anton Jameson scored 50 against the Sonics. He became...
In Seattle?
Yeah, Key Arena.
With the Wizards?
No, this is with the Warriors. And he scored 50 again the next game. And there's some sort of record regarding the back-to-back 50-point games. But I like kept the ticket stub from that game.
That might have been one that when we were splitting the tickets, you went to the game and I didn't. If it would have been Anton on the Warriors, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, it was early enough that I was not working for the Sonics, so it had to have been like 2001.
Did AI drop like 50 with the Nuggets one time or something?
At Key Arena?
I remember AI having a really good game with the Nuggets.
I don't think at Key Arena. There was a game where they scored like 174 against the Sonics. One person has scored 50 since then. That person being Luka Doncic.
Okay.
So
the to bring this all the way back around to basketball in Seattle.
As one does.
The Bam Adebayo 83-point game is actually kind of like the Brian Windhorst thing. And the same with baseball, right? The slog of baseball is that anytime you go to something, if you're there, and I mean, watching on TV is one thing, but being there in person, the best part about it is that minuscule chance that you're going to see something that has never happened before,
like
or happens so rarely
until there's a base runner working on a perfect game.
Exactly.
You never know. Could
you never know if that's going to happen. Somebody's going to hit five home runs. There's going to be a 21 inning game. Like the second you, and that is really what sports is almost, especially in that time period, is based off of, is like you might see something that has never happened before at that sporting event. There might be a fight, something like that. Like the stuff that you remember the most from sporting events, of which we've both been to a lot, are those moments where it's kind of random.
Your argument is that we've been to a lot of sporting events. I agree.
I'm not making an argument with that. I'm just saying.
Saying it was a funny thing to note. Like, I think the listener knows that we've been to a lot of sporting events.
That it would be an interesting. You've probably been to more than me, but it's not that many more. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Professional sporting events? Are you counting youth baseball?
No, I'm counting, like, I've been to so many more football games than you, though.
I guess that's true. But, like, I would go to 15 to 20 Blazers games a year for most of the time. And, you know, another 10 to 15 Storm games.
Oh, yeah, Storm
games.
Plus,
there was a long period
really
of time where I was credentialed for you to men's basketball.
Yeah, okay. I think Storm games is probably, like, that pushes you way over the edge.
This is literally my job, as a reminder.
Well, it's also because if the Storm, you know, how many home Storm games are there? You're like 20?
Now there are 22. I mean, for most of the time that, you know, I was around, it was 16 or 17.
But for NFL, even if I have, like, you know,
yeah,
15 years of NFL or whatever it is, more,
right,
that's still just only, you know, 8 to 10 games. Anyway, so the point is, that's like what is great about having an NBA team. And
exactly.
I think that's
you can't have a player score or allow 83 points.
But also the thing
if you don't have
forget,
an NBA team.
And this is what I'm going to do. This is the moment we're doing it right now. The best thing about basketball coming back to Seattle is not the big moments, right? If basketball were to come back to Seattle, B plus chance, it's not the big grand moments, right? Those are fun, obviously. But it is the small moments of having a basketball team here, whether you're a season ticket holder or not, of just following along with the team every single time. That moment when you see, remember Rashard Lewis, right, out of high school, a full season. He was kind of an anomaly for a lot of those players. A full season of just like a couple of glimpses where you're like, I think this guy might end up being good. And you get so excited about those moments. I mean, we even had Big Bob Swift, right? Robert Swift, where you're like, those moments, that is what's exciting about having a team in Seattle. And it's a hard thing to recreate if you don't have a team here, or if you've just adopted a team, because it's hard to get granular. You know, like sometimes there'll be those like Reddit threads where it's like, what's a thing a person can say that will let you know? There's an Inglourious Basterds moment, right? Where it's like, what's a thing that can happen where you can tell that somebody isn't from your home country or your home city or whatever, right? They pronounce something wrong. They call it Pike's Place Market. Something like that, right?
Yep.
They don't have an order at Dick's. Those sort of things. If you have a team in your city, like there's certain things that you get to see with that team, watching them every single day, getting excited about the young players, building towards something, like getting to know veterans, or all of a sudden being like, whoa, that guy, Flip Murray's stretch, right? Yep. Like those moments when you get excited, like nobody would believe that of all of my favorite Sonics ever, like you'd rank them and it's like Danny Fortson is like third or something. You know what I mean? Like those types of situations that it's not like, yes, Kevin Payton, they're great, but actually the players that you really like fall in love with are not necessarily those players.
And that's why I'm still upset about the Eric Snow trade.
Yeah.
Even though plausibly returned Rashard Lewis. All right.
We did the post-pod talk right now. You can put this at the end if you want.
No, I'm not going to. I think this, it makes sense where it is in context.
We circled back around. Talked right about NBA to Seattle. That's what I'm excited about, though. And the same thing when you draft players. Because like when I watch the draft and I'm like Scoot Henderson or somebody, I'm like, the amount that I'm actually, granted, I feel like he's been hurt a lot.
Did have a nice game. I was down there last Friday. Did have a nice game against the Jazz.
I'm not dialed enough. I'm dialed in just enough to know about Caleb Love, or at least I don't know if people still care about Caleb Love.
He has not played in months.
So sad. I loved Caleb Love. But like those types, I'm not paying enough attention to the Blazers to actually be locked in and be like, damn, Scoot just did that.
Right.
You know, because I know those moments are happening. And it's like someday. And then you see teams all of a sudden where you're like, the Pistons are good. You know, like, but Pistons fans probably a year ago were like, just wait for next year.
Yeah.
You know, like they knew ahead of everybody else because they were so dialed in on those players. And a lot of times you're wrong. You know, a lot of times it's
more
not
more times
right.
than not you're wrong. Mostly it's Antonacci striking out.
But the times that you're right, those are the most fun times. You know, those are the times where you see a young player and you're like, just wait for this player to put it all together. And again, 98% of the time they don't. But when they do and become a player like Rashard Lewis or whatever, and you get to see them kind of grow into that player, that stuff is very, very fun. And you can kind of only get it by watching basically every single game.
And that's why you feel the way you do about the Seattle Kraken is a lifelong
Hello.
Kraken fan as we turn to the roundup. And the Kraken are surging with back-to-back wins after their losing streak previously reached four
ESPN games. ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton in shambles.
They beat Vancouver and Florida by a combined 11-4 margin. The difference between those streaks, the debut of Bobby McMahon, their trade deadline acquisition, who had 3 goals and 2 assists
Wow!
In his first 2 Kraken appearances. They entered play Monday tied for the 8th and final playoff spot. Let me now update that on the fly, assuming these games are over. It looks like the Kings did not play, so they are still sitting tied for 8th in the West.
Look, if we get playoff hockey, we're going to be all in on playoff hockey. Are we not?
I did think about this and like, yes, if they get the 8th seed, like there's still a chance they can win 2 rounds if they get the 8th seed because hockey is just like that. So I guess there is something to be said for it, certainly.
Will be in the playoffs.
They wrap up a stretch of nearly 3 weeks in the Pacific Northwest by hosting Tampa Bay on Tuesday before they out on a 5-game road trip. Their last extended one of the season. All right, Seattle Sounders. So I was woefully unaware that last Thursday in Vancouver was actually leg one of the Sounders CONCACAF Champions League matchup against the Whitecaps, who had advanced in the play-in round to take on the Sounders, who automatically were through by virtue of their League's Cup championship last year. And let me tell you, the Whitecaps, still undefeated in MLS play, didn't know what hit them.
Wow.
And what hit them was, oops, all Paul's. Paul Areola scored twice, giving him 4 Sounders goal in CONCACAF Champions Cup play, 3 of them assisted by his former FC Dallas teammate, Jesus Ferreira, on the edge of halftime and in the 58th minute. And then Paul Rothrock added a 3rd in the 70th minute, while Stefan Fry kept a clean sheet, facing just 2 shots on goal, despite Vancouver outshooting Seattle 16-10. So Sounders a dominant lead as they come back stateside for the second leg at their home away from home in Spokane at One Spokane Stadium this Wednesday night, 8 p.m. on Fox Sports 2, needing only to lose by 2 goals or better to advance to the quarterfinals of CONCACAF Champions Cup. So sitting pretty going into that one.
Okay, let me come back to hockey for a second. They play 82 games in hockey, right? Same as the NBA?
Yes, although I believe they are expanding the schedule. I don't think it's this season, but maybe it is this season. They're eventually going to play 84 games.
The schedule?
Yeah.
Why?
Because hockey players don't have load management.
Okay. All right, I guess I'm for it, I suppose.
Yeah, that starts in the 2026-27 schedule.
That's really funny. Okay, so the Kraken only have 16 games left, right?
Yes.
We are going to be dialed in for those last 16 matches of this season. Are they called matches in hockey or games?
They are not. No.
Okay. We are going to be watching who the 3 stars are of every game, every power play, every other hockey word.
You're going to be keeping a close eye on icing.
Yeah, a lot of icings, making sure that they're called correctly. But I'm saying, like, legitimately, okay, maybe not all 16 games, but as we get down to 10 games, they are so close in this playoff hunt right now, tied with the Kings with a game in hand against the Kings.
And the San Jose Sharks, one point back, and the Sharks have a game in hand over the Kraken.
I've been telling you, I'm just about to start paying attention to hockey.
For like 3 solid years here.
And no, one year. What? Just this season. This season, I've told you, I'm just about to start paying attention to hockey. And I'm doing it again.
Wow.
Right now, these 16 games, I'm going to watch as many of them as I can.
All right, so the Sounders, in between the 2
legs. I make no such vow about the Sounders.
Of their CONCACAF Champions Cup matchup against Vancouver, they played at San Jose on Sunday, and Paul Rothrock scored again as the Sounders rotated heavily in between, including two Tacoma Defiance call-ups in their starting 11. One of those players, center back Antino Lopez, saved the day with a hustling clearance off the line in the 74th minute to prevent what looked like a sure equalizer for the Earthquakes after Andrew Thomas was able to get a hand on that. Instead, the Sounders saw out another clean sheet in an improbable win where San Jose had 3xG to the Sounders 0.5 with a 25-7 edge in shots and double the shots on goal. So a wildly undeserved win that the Sounders will take nonetheless. San Jose's first loss in MLS play. No break for the Sounders after this week, after the CONCACAF Champions Cup play, as they travel to Minnesota at the weekend. The Loons lost 6-0 to an angry Vancouver squad on Sunday, falling to 1-2-1 on the season. I mean, Vancouver has been like, I don't know if they've been far and away, but they have been the best team in MLS in MLS regular season matchups, and then just completely got dominated by the Sounders in the CONCACAF Champions Cup. They have a plus 13 goal differential right now. No one else in MLS is better than plus 8. Our Seattle Reign FC got things started Sunday with a 2-1 win in Orlando. Their season opener was delayed 3 hours at halftime by lightning. The Reign at that point held the lead through Jess Fishlock, and after Barbara Banda equalized for the Pride in the second half, newcomer Brittany Ratcliffe scored the winner in the 83rd minute, coming off the bench in her Reign debut to get them off to a victorious start. Reign will continue MLS play this week with the, as I do it on the fly here, they will be visiting the rival Portland Thorns on Friday night on Prime Video at 7 p.m. So a derby match at Providence Park. All right, UW Women's Basketball. We are getting ready for the NCAA tournament. We now know that the Huskies are the number 6 seed in the Sacramento 4 bracket, headed to Fort Worth, where in the opening game on Friday morning at 11:30 a.m. Pacific time, they will face South Dakota State, winner of the Summit League. The Jackrabbits beat North Dakota State in the championship game after finishing a game back in the conference regular season, earning their fourth consecutive tournament berth. And notably, like, look, this is not just a hapless mid-major that's happy to be there. They have won their opening game twice in those 3 years, including last year over Oklahoma State, is a 10 seed. They returned two starters from that team, including their star player, 6'2" center Brooklyn Meyer, who averaged 22 points, 8 rebounds, nearly 2 blocks per game on 65% shooting. Wing Madison Mathewitz, the other senior starter, was the only other Jackrabbit to average double figures, but South Dakota State ranked 29th in three-point percentage at 35%, in addition to third in the nation inside the arc. The terrific defensive rebounding team rarely foul in a conservative defense that concedes a lot of threes. Besides beating North Dakota State twice, their best wins were beating Gonzaga at the nearby Sanford Pentagon, and then they also beat Kansas State in Cancun. They played three top 16 teams in the NCAA tournament that are hosting this weekend. They lost at Duke to North Carolina in Cancun, and then at home against Texas in a game that was reasonably competitive. They were down by 10 in the third quarter, 4 in the second quarter, that one. So, you know, somewhat similar to UW giving UCLA, another one of the number one seeds, a couple of competitive games, although they did not get to host the Bruins. They played them on the road and in the Big Ten tournament. So I watched the South Dakota State-Texas game back to get a little better feel for what we can expect from this one. It's interesting because, you know, I think usually you think about classically this high major versus mid-major kind of matchup in the 6-11 range, and you're assuming, oh, it's going to be the mid-major that's going to have, you know, the good guards but be kind of undersized. And in this case, the key is how the Huskies, who are our smaller team up front, can handle Brooklyn Meyer, and how much Yulia Grabovskaya we see as kind of a defensive matchup to deal with her, as opposed to Bryn McGoy being able to defend Brooklyn Meyer one-on-one in the post and stay out of foul trouble. I think that's going to be the key thing here, because South Dakota State, you know, this is obviously a ridiculous comparison, but understand it and how I'm saying it. It's a little like the Rockets Akeem teams, where it's like, we don't have any other stars, but we have a number of other shooters. So when we dump it down to our star center in the post, if you double, we're going to kick it out for threes. And if not, we're confident that she's going to be able to score one-on-one. So then they were surprisingly competitive defensively against Texas. They made Madison Booker, the Longhorn star, really work for things offensively. It'll be interesting to see, you know, the Huskies, I'd say, would say have a more diverse perimeter attack than even Texas does, in terms of just, you know, we saw in the Big Ten tournament when Xavier Sellers was almost completely a non-factor that they were able to advance in the first round anyway, beating USC behind a big game from Elle Ladine. If Ladine keeps up her strong play, I think that's a very good sign for the Huskies. But South Dakota State coming in hot. They had their two losses in conference play relatively early on, and since then, I believe, have won 11 in a row. Don't have that in my notes, but let me double check that.
How do
10 in a row, yeah.
Some of the prognosticators, you know, you sort of can kind of catch a wind. I feel like this is mostly more in the men's NCAA tournament, but people, if there's going to be an upset, you know, people sort of feel it, right? Or at least they feel that they have an idea of that. How are people like the Bart Torvik stats wise, and then also sort of like the general feeling around this game? What is that in this one?
So Bart Torvik has them as 9-point favorites in this one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Which is more than the official spread, right? The spread is something like 5.5.
84% chance of winning. So yeah, Bart Torvik's, I think, relatively higher on the Huskies. I mean, they're, you know, number 19 in the rankings, which would have translated to a 5 seed if you were going by that. And, you know, most people were thinking about them as a 7 seed, and obviously they ended up with the 6 seed. So
is San Diego State a little bit overseeded or underseeded? Or San Diego State. Is South Dakota State also a little bit underseeded, or are they about appropriate per advanced stats?
About appropriate. The two 11 seeds that are ahead of them are the two teams that are squaring off in the first four, including Nebraska, who is like the Big Ten is really comes out really well in Bart Torvik's rankings relative to conventional wisdom. So Nebraska, which was one of the last two teams into the field, is number 26 overall, is actually rated ahead of number 6 seed Baylor in that.
Interesting.
One.
How much is the women's tournament? Because I Ken Palm is a thing that the men's tournament is using. I felt like maybe the seeding was a little bit. It was a little bit more off Ken Palm wise this year than it has been in the past, but
maybe a little bit.
Do you feel like for the women's committee, they're using, like, is Bart Torvik a thing that they use?
I don't know if it specifically is. They are using wins above bubble, which is a thing that if you're using it publicly, you're going to go. So, I mean, there's a difference between your, you know, your ranking, your Ken Palm ranking or your Bart Torvik ranking and your wins above bubble, which is measuring more, you know, is not concerned with how large the margins is, just kind of who did you beat and where, you know, relative, what does that look like relative to expectations? So there is some disconnect between that. So you look at someone like, you know, Minnesota is an example of a Big Ten team that, again, Bart Torvik has number 8 in the country, but they were a 4 seed, but that's about where their wins above bubble was. They were only 17th in that measure.
Yeah, but isn't the Big Ten just very good? So you're going to end up with less wins if you're playing in a hard conference?
Well, that's not how wins above bubble works, no.
Okay, what does wins above bubble mean then?
It's relative to a bubble team playing the same schedule that you did. How many more wins did you get?
Okay, I see. It's not a literal wins above bubble.
Correct.
Okay. That's like a weighted stat.
But USC, another wildly underseeded team by this measure, 9 seed, they were 20th overall in Bart Torvik.
How well do you think Bart Torvik has fared for the women's NCAA tournament? Do you know this? I mean, it hasn't been that many years of it, right?
It is not. They've only been doing it for a couple of years here. But I mean, the Bart Torvik ratings are functionally very similar to Ken Palm. So
and Ken Palm fares like fairly well overall.
I mean, the other thing is, look, the NCAA women's tournament, as we've talked about, is much more predictable than the men's tournament based on the combination of both the relative dominance of the top teams and the fact that the top 4 seeds get to host.
Is that also true at the kind of like the this tier. I know that's true with the very top seeds, but is that also true in the tier that the Huskies are in as a sixth seed?
That there tends to be relatively more dominant?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so.
You don't have the same sort of like 11-6 upsets that you might have 12-5 or something like that.
Not as frequently as on the men's side. So I noticed that Nate Silver called this out as a matchup that, you know, could be relatively closer than expected for the 11-6 line. He was basing that partially on
that guy.
His model uses ELO, and he noted that it's somewhat heavily weighted for recent performance, where, as we mentioned, South Dakota State comes in on a winning streak, and including the two wins over North Dakota State, their biggest rival in the Summit League.
Maybe stick to burritos, buddy. Is your video working, by the way?
I guess it's not.
Oh, there you are. There you are.
I must have accidentally clicked off
of
it. Hello. I don't know what I was hiding here, but I must have clicked off of it.
Okay, what is your feeling on this game?
I think the Huskies will very likely win, but that it will probably be, you know, it will probably be a slog. It'll probably be a fairly close game. I mean, foul trouble, I think, is going to be just a really crucial factor here, whether the Huskies can keep their centers on the court. And if Brooklyn Meyer gets in foul trouble, conversely, for South Dakota State, like, that is a pretty huge problem for them. Although they did go on a run against North Dakota State in the Summit League final when Meyer was sitting. So they, you know, they handled her absence with a couple of early fouls pretty well.
And this is Friday at 11:30 a.m.
Friday at 11:30 a.m. ESPN News.
All right.
So speaking of host teams, the host team of this mini four-team regional is the number three seed TCU, which features a lot of familiar faces. They'll play number I wrote down South Dakota State. I'm confident South Dakota State is not both the number 11 seed and the number 14 seed, which would be a remarkable.
UC, it's like San Diego is who you're thinking.
Yes, coached by former Storm assistant coach Heidi Vanderburg.
All right,
way back in the day. That's going back. I was going to say it's like Louisiana Tech, is it, that's got the two conference schedules for next year that are on the same days?
I love that.
That's what South Dakota State's doing in the tournament, playing a doubleheader. So TCU has a lot of familiar faces. They're coached by longtime Oregon State and Oregon assistant coach Mark Campbell, who is actually someone I kind of wanted for the UW job when they hired Tina Langley, guided the team to the Elite Eight last year. They have basically an entirely different roster this year. Last year, it was Haley Van Lith, Kashmir native, and Oregon transfer Sedona Prince were their star players. This year, they added as transfers WNBA prospects Olivia Miles and Marcha Suarez. Suarez, the Huskies faced in 2023-24 when she was at Cal. Miles, it'll be interesting if the Huskies play her, because I think right now she is a very likely pick for the Storm at number three. She's, you know,
I was
going to
say, I know that
them.
Name, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, we've talked about this person, right?
Well, we talked about her a lot last year when we thought the Storm might take her number two. And then she instead decided not to declare for the draft, entered the transfer portal from Notre Dame, ended up at TCU, has had a terrific sixth year, really, of her college career. So, you know, I think she's a strong candidate to go in the top three and, you know, probably the most likely of those three players to be out there at number three for the Storm. So that'll be interesting. They are the lowest ranked number three seed on Bart Torvik. So not as high on the Big 12, but number one in the nation in opponent 2-point percentage. They boast a pair of 6'7" rim protectors in Clara Silva and Kennedy Basham, the latter of whom started her career in Oregon. So another player who will be familiar to the Huskies if they are to advance, and so does TCU.
Not a game that's impossible.
No, if you know, the thing I was sort of looking for was comparisons. They're around the same tier in Bart Torvik as Maryland, who's a team the Huskies went on the road and beat.
And then how has UW fared? This is looking way, way ahead of ourselves against Iowa in their previous matchups.
I mean, this is too far ahead of ourselves, I would say. They were competitive at Iowa. They only played the once, lost 65-56 back in February.
Okay.
So there you go. NCAA tournament. This is, I mean, they were in the first four last year. That was fun, an important step in this.
It was not fun at all.
It was the idea of it was fun. The actual game itself, I agree, was not fun. an important step in this Tina Langley rebuild, you know, is the first postseason for the UW women since 2017. But now it is a real legitimate NCAA tournament game, and one in which they are favored to win. So it's a big moment and a big opportunity.
Okay. And then you'll be posting on the Discord and on Blue Sky, anywhere else, I suppose. Maybe in the post note, the Peltoncast tournament challenge, both for the men and women.
Yes, yes, we'll get that going for sure.
Did you feel like the men's side, like a lot of the like 11, 12 seeds, maybe were worse than I feel like KenPom wise than they have been in the past? Or is it normal for those teams to be pretty low? Because I was like, High Point's like a team that people are like, oh, they could have an upset. I'm like, they're 92nd.
That is quite low. There was an interesting post I read today. Let me see. Who's that by? That was by Jordan Sperber of Hoop Vision in his newsletter, breaking down that power conference double-digit seeds tend to be much more successful than mid-major double-digit seeds, even at the same seed line. So that there's some sort of factor there. So if you're seeing an unusual number of, you know, the mid-major champions in those spots, then perhaps so.
Like an NC State would fare better than like a High Point or something.
Or Santa Clara would probably be the natural comparison here, where those teams, Santa Clara's a 10, NC State's an 11. They're identical in KenPom ratings. But even relative to that, there's probably some slight advantage for NC State.
Interesting.
Utah State's a 9 seed. Sure, doing just fine, Utah State. This could be.
God damn it. I did not even think about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, we'll talk briefly about the UW men season coming to an end. I thought they acquitted themselves incredibly well at the Big Ten tournament.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I genuinely enjoyed watching all their games, but both of their games.
I was going to say all of their games. Respect to the 7-man Huskies, who, you know, you were nervously sitting there wondering, is BJ Roy going to be called upon at some point due to foul outs in the overtime against USC? But we're, you know, down, let's see, 11 points in the second half to UCLA, 58-47, come back and eventually win that one in overtime despite a quiet night for Hannes Steinbach. Get 22 points, 11 assists from Zoom Diallo, making a lot of plays down the stretch, a big 15 points from Wesley Yates. And then against a really good Wisconsin team that eventually...
clearly very good Wisconsin team.
That eventually pushed Michigan nearly to the limit after beating Illinois in OT the next day. Come down to a final shot against them in an 85-82 loss. Despite Wisconsin, like if you're thinking, oh, yeah, of course, you know, sure, there's a way the Huskies could upset Wisconsin. It's going to require Wisconsin shooting terribly from three. They shot 15 of 39 from three, and still the Huskies were right there. So a really admirable effort. Hannes Steinbach with 25 and 16, as well as three blocks. And we'll see what may have been his last college game. 24 points and 7 assists for Zoom Diallo, who really, like, retaining, you know, obviously it would be great if they can get Steinbach back. But in terms of, like, building continuity in the program, Zoom Diallo is clearly priority number one.
Oh, to me, it's him and Yates. I think Wesley Yates also. Yeah.
I think Wesley Yates will have a better season next year. Discouraging that a hitch in his shot developed at some point this season. So, a lot of time in the offseason to work on that.
I think this must have been in the USC game, but there was a moment where there was like a crucial play that they needed to score. And it was just Cortland Muldrew just comes down.
There was a lot of Cortland Muldrew in the USC game.
I love that in this crucial moment, Cortland Muldrew's like, got this, guys.
Well, USC was kind of like, look, we're going to make Cortland Muldrew beat us. And damn it if he didn't. Played 27 minutes against SC, 33 against Wisconsin.
I mean, so he's somebody who, like, I definitely want now. Back if, yeah. if that
question.
Is a possibility. The thing that sucks,
or 31 against Wisconsin.
I'm fine if Topina goes. But the thing that is...
it was not a great run for Topina with Frank Kempong out for the end of the season.
The you just don't know if any of these players are going to be back. I mean, obviously, there's some that we know aren't, but like, not even just Hannah Steinbach, but I'm talking about like Yates and Zoom, where it's kind of like UW hopefully has the money and values them to a certain extent.
I mean, just, they definitely have the money. It's not like there's anyone they cannot afford to keep. I mean, maybe Hannah Steinbach they could not afford to keep if he decided to enter the transfer portal and eventually withdrew from the NBA draft. Everyone else, they have the money. It's just a question of like who prioritizes the most and who do they prioritize.
It is really a complicated thing, though, when you have to just kind of like reset your roster every single year in a way that in football, it makes it a little bit easier because there's certain players where just like having a starting job, you're probably going to keep those players.
And just because the volume of players is such that they, it would not, no one wants them all to be free agents.
Yeah.
Not the players, not the teams.
So that like the continuity is more consistent in football, but in basketball where you're basically like, I've got this pot of money. I know these players, but how enamored are you with other players? And it's a really complicated thing to put together. And I'm saying you can make a very good team if zero of these players are back from this current UW program. It's not like they won't, but it would be kind of nice to take a core into 2027.
And I think as compared to last year, Danny Sprinkle is going to feel better about this group, even if, you know, it didn't accomplish what we were hoping to. I mean, the funny thing is, like, as we've talked about, their KenPom rating barely moved the entire season. It finally went down a little bit in the last 2 weeks, you know, after they were basically completely shorthanded in the front court.
Okay, I saw his post-game speech, though, Danny Sprinkle. I gotta say, he might need to go to the Ben Johnson school of post-game speeches. He may need to take a shirt off at some point. I was like, honestly, I'm a little underwhelmed right now. I should be more hyped about this victory against USC. The team was like pretty happy, sprayed some water on them, I believe. But I was a little bit like the speech itself. I was like, you just watch every week. They post every winning coach in the NFL, right? There's 16 winning coaches. You watch those, process them, figure it out. Danny Sprinkle has to work on that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm more concerned with getting three-point shooting on the roster, but okay, that too. It was notably, we should mention, the Huskies' first men's basketball tournament win since 2022, which okay. is just like, how can they be so bad for so long? Oh, boy.
Oh, they were not next year.
They were not invited to either the NIT or the College Basketball Crown Tournament, thus ending their season. The Sprinkle said that he hoped to continue playing. So,
there me you too. Where is he going to keep playing?
Well, he said, but previous to, it wasn't like obviously there are many high major.
There's some frat bros who better watch out at the IMA.
I mean, that is in practice what men's basketball players typically do. Yes. I mean,
Danny Sprinkle says he wants to continue playing. So watch your back, kids.
I've heard many great stories from my 6'8" friend who played at the IMA against the likes of Nate Robinson.
I know you're 6'5" in the Lakeside you dominated, but shit's about to get real.
All right. UW softball swept.
You think
Maryland.
You have a silky smooth jumper there? Bud.
UW softball swept Maryland Sandwich in a 1-0 win Saturday with Morgan Reimer throwing a 4-hit shutout in between two lopsided wins by a combined 20-4 score. I've now won 12 in a row. They host North Dakota on Wednesday in a one-off matchup before heading out on their first Big Ten road trip to play at Michigan, which was swept at Nebraska to open conference play last weekend. Should be pretty good weather in Ann Arbor with highs in the 50s this weekend, but the Wolverines, one of the stronger softball programs in the Big Ten, so will be a better measuring stick, I think, for UW than playing at home against Maryland and Northwestern. Let's wrap up.
Rutgers was 124 in KenPom, and they got chosen for the College Basketball Crown.
Wait, they did? Really?
This is bullshit. Now they're really going to have to take it out on some frat bros.
They didn't even have a better record. I mean, maybe the Huskies did decline their opportunity. I don't know.
Well, I've never heard of the College Basketball Crown until literally today. So, but now I'm mad about their selection process.
Unless the Huskies did decline it, which I don't know. I may need to continue doing some research here. If you're gonna, do you have any more Sonics takes you can fill for?
Danny Fortson. Look, Nick Collison. Chris Wilcox. I mean, okay. Who could forget Vlade Radmanovic? Obviously, Peja Drobniak.
Friend of the pod, Damon Agnes, definitely cannot forget Vlade Radmanovic.
Yeah, he's not. Well, I don't know if wasn't as much of a Drobniak's maniac as Vlade.
He's more of a Vlade guy. More of them walking out of a Bruce Springsteen concert saying how horrible the music was kind of guy.
Wait, what? Vlade did this?
Yeah, Brett Barry took Vlade Radmanovic and Peja Drobniak to a Springsteen concert.
And they were like, this music is terrible?
Yes.
I feel like there might be some cultural things that...
Sure. I agree with that.
I'm not going to overly judge Vlade Radmanovic for this.
It's more about the walking out part of it. Like, I can't imagine a concert that I would dislike so much. I mean, granted, I don't have, you know, the alternative entertainment options that 21-year-old Vladimir Radmanovich did, but they left after 30. Apparently, yeah.
I did have stuff.
Vitaly Potapenko was also at this.
What was this cast of characters Brent Barry was taking to this concert?
Agent David Bauman, who got the players the tickets, got a cell phone call from, I love that it was a cell phone call, because in 2002 you noted that, from Radmanovich during the concert. This sucks, we're out of here, Radmanovich said. Recalling the incident, Bauman said, I told him that Springsteen was an American icon, but he didn't like it. I said, if I were in Belgrade listening to some local artist, I'd at least hang out for an hour. Which I agree with.
I don't know. It's hard. That's podcast gold rule territory. You don't know until David Bauman is in Belgrade listening to an artist if he would hang out for an hour. It's an easy thing to say right now.
I just can't think of a concert that I've ever like walked out during the middle of the actual concert. I mean, I get like,
I've definitely left. I go to so many shows where I'm watching the opener and I'm like, peace.
Sure, but you like halfway through, you're
the headliner for sure. Yes. Okay. I'd be like, I'll like check out a few songs and then I go.
All right, that's fair. But you're not like, this sucks, I'm out of here.
Sometimes I am.
Oh no.
I just David Bauman imagining his like Ari Gold moment with U2, where he's like, I got you tickets, kids. You're gonna see the boss. And then Vladimir Radmanovich is like, this is sucks.
The next time, I don't know when the next time, I haven't seen Barry in a while, but the next time I see him, I'm going to have to ask him about this story.
Do you think was it Brent Barry's agent? And he was like, yo, can you get me some
not
tickets?
His agent. I'm very confident.
It's Vladdy's agent.
Because I think David Bauman's a kind of an international specialist.
It was Vlad. Well, okay. If he is an international specialist, David Bauman may have been to a concert in Belgrade.
Exactly.
I'm just saying I wouldn't rule it out that you would do that. You'd be like, I don't understand this at all. I'm leaving. Like Timothy Chalamet with the opera or the ballet.
David Bauman's current client list. This is not as international heavy as I thought it would be.
Probably after that Springsteen incident.
He hung on to Peja Stojakovic.
There we go.
It's unclear whether like Vlade Radmanovic changed agents or just is not listed on this.
I mean,
who
would be Vlade? Does you think Vlade Radmanovic needs an agent right now?
He does not, but no, just Peja Stojakovic, and he's still listed. Metal World Peace.
It's like, okay, think about this. So like when big booking agencies, if there are bands that are basically defunct, right? They stay on the roster because you want to impress people with them on the roster. I'm so sorry to the great Vlade Radmanovic. Doesn't carry that same kind of weight that Peja Stojakovic has.
Not the same kind of weight as Andrew Bogut, who is still on here. Reggie Bullock, who's been out of the league for a while, I'm sure.
Okay, Reggie Bullock could probably go. That's like I'm a
sure he's officially
website.
Announced his retirement.
But that was like a generation after Vlade.
Meta World Peace.
Meta World Peace stays on the
sense.
Site for sure.
And
yeah.
Josh Heifeld to really bring this full circle with UW men's basketball. Is that two consecutive pods we've had a Josh Heifeld reference?
Two pods too many.
All right, let's talk about the Seahawks, who have actually signed some players in free agency, but not those players.
Not those players. I was trying to see if there's anybody that botched books at Billions, whereas like, I mean, for a long time, Pavement sat on the roster and didn't play a show for years and years and years.
But it's a little different in music because like A band can reform more easily than like Peja Stojakovic can come out of retirement at this
think about
point.
This. Peja Stojakovic has a son right now
it
playing competitive college basketball.
NBA
you think David
prospect.
Bauman doesn't want to sign him?
Okay. I don't know. I think David Bauman might be retired based on this list of players.
I like this podcast really been heavy on, what was the guy's name? Dave Nielsen?
Yes, oops, all Daves.
Dave Nielsen and Dave Bauman.
Boy. Well, you never, you know, this is the beauty of the Pelton cast. You never know where you're going to end up. You start out going one direction, you end up talking about David Bauman and David Nielsen. So the Seahawks have signed a handful of players, all for the minimum, so non-qualifying comp pick contracts. If there the question last week was like, how committed are they to this comp pick thing? And the answer now seems clear that they are fully committed to it. So sitting on a fourth rounder right now for, let's see, that was the Boye Mafe contract and fifth rounders for Ken Walker III, Reek Woolen, and Kobe Bryant. So they added a running back, Packers running back Emmanuel Wilson, to a one-year deal at the minimum. Wilson spent three seasons with Green Bay after going undrafted out of Fort Valley State, getting 100-plus carries each of the last 2 years and combining for nearly 1,000 yards. Not a significant factor as a receiver out of the backfield, and in disconcerting news, his 64 PFF grade ranked 53rd of 55 qualifying running backs last year. So I'm not sure this is the week one starter. Your look is not great podcasting.
I don't know. I kind of like Emmanuel Wilson, but I'm just like, this doesn't solve, it doesn't fill a hole. And this is the first time, we'll see if the Seahawks sign somebody else, but like, it is weird to me that I care about the position of running back, but like, this team's going to run the ball a lot. You know, it's not like the new offensive scheme is going to be that different than the previous one. And it did seem to be helpful having both Ken Walker and Zach Charbonnet on the roster. If you're just, I'm worried about this from the perspective, not of that the Seahawks won't be able to run the ball, but from the perspective of they're going to do something dumb.
That is plausible. Yeah.
With regards to the position of running back, like not signing Rashad White, was that to avoid because he got more than the veteran minimum? We'll entertain anybody as long as it doesn't cost us our comp picks.
I mean, I think Rashad White probably, what did he get from the Commanders? My guess is $2 million with the percentage potential to reach $4 million through incentives. So yeah, maybe they were offering a veteran minimum there. I would have liked to sign that contract with Rashad White. At safety,
they're blowing a draft pick on a running back. I'm telling you this right now. The Seahawks are drafting a running back.
I mean, I don't know. Depending on what draft pick it is, I don't know.
The Seahawks are drafting a running back earlier than you want them to draft a running back.
They usually tend to. So,
and also the Ken Walker thing, like they are positively reinforced for that pick.
Oh, without question. So, at safety, they added Rodney Thomas II from the Colts, also a one-year minimum contract, a seventh-round pick in 2022 out of Yale, who started 25 games his first two seasons, just won his last two, had four interceptions as a rookie. They also brought back Panthers safety D'Anthony Bell, who was signed by the Seahawks last March, bounced between their practice squad and the 53-man roster, seeing action in 14 games with two starts before being claimed off waivers by Carolina on New Year's Day. And not actually playing for the Panthers in their season finale. So some depth there. Pretty clear that Ty Okada is going to step into that starting role, and they're just sort of figuring out who's going to be behind him in those spots on the roster, which is the role that D'Anthony Bell played much of last year when the Seahawks had injuries in the secondary. And then they also signed Commanders cornerback Noah Igbinohene, a first-round pick by the Dolphins in 2020, who never cracked the starting lineup in Miami before being traded to Dallas in 2023. Igbinohene followed the Cowboys defensive coordinator Dan Quinn to Washington, made a career-high 10 starts in 2024 is a nickelback. Started just twice last year, but did play 37% of defensive snaps for Washington. I thought this was interesting. Both his parents were Olympians representing Nigeria in, you guessed it, track and field. Despite that athletics background, he's not really a notable athlete. Thomas had the best relative athletic score of this group of players the Seahawks have added.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, Thomas has some pretty big time scores in agility. Seahawks also re-signed a number of their own free agents to more modest contracts. Josh Jones, who is probably their most significant remaining unrestricted free agent. Special teams contributor Brady Russell. Defensive tackle Brandon Peely.
I think it's Igbinoghene.
Yeah, I did not handle it as well as I was hoping to.
Do you want to restart the whole podcast?
Yeah, it seems like a good thing. Quarterback Shamar.
You know that part's getting deleted anytime Kevin makes any mistake at all.
Well, it's when I can
you're like, I have
easily.
A perfect track record on the podcast, never said a thing wrong. Who's in charge of the button? I'm actually kind of excited about this signing. I think the Seahawks have done pretty well with players with some pedigree, and especially secondary players. Like, there's a reason that he was taken in the first round. You know, it's not like...
I'm still not sure I've determined what that reason is, because I was assuming based on, like, you know, when I read the bio, I was like, oh, let me check out his relative athletic score. I bet it was really amazing. And then it just was fine. Was fully adequate. Because it seemed like, oh, this guy jumped up at the combine, and he didn't. So I still don't, but yes, I mean, certainly, you know, there is pedigree there.
Yeah, no, I think this is a dude that the Seahawks, that Mike McDonald can turn into a competitive player.
Two kickoff returns for touchdowns at Auburn.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he must have been fairly athletic, but.
I mean, his 40 was thoroughly okay. And he's not very big, which is why I think the nickel sort of makes more sense for him.
5 tackles and 2 pass breakups in the season opener against the University of Washington. Do you remember that game?
I do. It was the day of Nate Duncan's wedding.
Oh, hello. Usually you remember things based upon sporting events. This
in that case, yes, it's the reverse.
Life event.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, but it could be the opposite. If you were to ask me, hey, when was Nate Duncan's wedding? I would remember, oh, it's week one of that season.
Mm-hmm.
Seahawks also brought back quarterback Shamar John Charles and long snapper Chris Stoll. So Stoll is certainly an important piece to the special teams puzzle.
Yeah. I think we understand what the plan is. I don't hate the idea of gathering a bunch of comp picks, but, you know, it doesn't help them this next season. But I also think they're kind of looking at this as like, and this is a good thing about having John Schneider locked up so long term, right? That he's not thinking about it one season at a time. I think the team probably is going to be worse next year, at least talent wise, you know? It'll almost be difficult for them not to be.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the argument that they would be better would have to be some sort of internal improvement, you know, primarily by Sam Darnold.
Well, it's still a young team, but I do think kind of a lot of that improvement happened already. Like, there are players, Nick Anwari is going to get better. Gray Zabel's going to get better.
I don't know that we can say that. I mean...
Or how about this? There is a chance that... Like, I think Gray Zabel, we can, like, fairly confidently.
Gray Zabel, I think, is pretty likely. Eman Worry just had such a great rookie season. I think it's kind of similar to Reek Woolen, where, like,
but
yes, on average, he you know, is on the upward trajectory in his development. But he, like, so far exceeded expectations that I do think there's a chance for a regression to the mean.
Nick Eman Worry was, like, first-round pick grade, basically. Reek Woolen was
sure,
not.
He finished second. In defensive rookie of the year vote.
No, Nicky Manori is good, obviously. Witherspoon also got better over time. He was great as a rookie, but he also got better by last season.
He got better, but he also, like, is with Reek Woolen again. His impact stats got worse. Like, Witherspoon did not make as many splash plays in year two as he did in year one.
That's fine though. He doesn't need to make splash plays to get
better.
But
those splash plays are poor, like are valuable to the team.
Well, he had one in the fucking Super Bowl. Is that not enough for you? Jan was like, "Oh, you love this Witherspoon guy. What's he ever done?" And I'm like, "Jan, I'm like the Sports Illustrated cover. Like that wasn't good enough for you."
My point is not Nick Emanuorya is going to be bad. My point is like development is not linear.
I agree that development is not linear, but like there is a good chance that he develops as a player overall. His feel for the game gets better. The splash plays might not happen, but that's not exactly the entire goal.
But I'm saying when it comes to the Seahawks winning games, those splash plays go a long ways in winning games and are not as likely to continue.
Did even Reek have like, or did Nick Emanuorya have that many of those this year?
I mean, 2.5 sacks. I would probably take the under on that one for next year. I don't know.
It's not like it's a crazy amount, though.
No.
The real reason that they're probably going to be worse is just it's really hard for somebody like JSN to replicate that season. And they were fairly lucky. They actually were quite lucky injury-wise overall. Yeah. I don't know if you saw that spreads for the 2026 NFL season.
Were you struggling with what year it is? No, I have not.
I was struggling with what year is going to be, which is the year it currently is. I mean, the Seahawks are favorites for the Super Bowl. They're tied with the Rams. It really does feel like people are looking at it, which makes sense, right? The season just ended, and they're like, these are the two best teams this year. Those will be the two best teams next year. As you can imagine, I'm a little bit more skeptical about one of those teams than the other. And that would be the team with the almost 40-year-old quarterback, but nobody seems to care. I want to say the Seahawks were the spread was the over under was 11.5.
I mean, that seems about right.
10.5.
Yeah. How many teams have higher? Baltimore has 11. Does Baltimore have an extremely easy schedule?
Hyped. I will say Baltimore, like statistically, Baltimore is a good team all year.
Wait, who's coaching the Ravens?
Jesse Minter.
Oh, okay. People are very excited about him.
I like Jesse Minter, but I don't think he is somebody who I'm like, oh, that's going to change. Like I feel much better about the Giants under John Harbaugh as new coach than I do about the Ravens. But yeah, that Ravens spread, and I think there's a few other teams who are 10.5. I was like, sure. That seems fair. I mean, they've got the Niners right there and the Rams also right there. So really, I think there's just a lot of good teams in the NFC West.
Baltimore does not have a notably easy schedule for next year, huh?
They just freaking love that team.
Okay.
Finding that one away?
It's unexpected information.
Jan was like, what would I make? She called me like literally out of the blue. Jan was like, what would I make if I bet $5 on the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl next year? And I was like, that is such a random question. I was like, you'd win like $60. And she was like, okay, what if I bet $5 on all of like the 8 best teams, you know, best odds? And she was like, I'd be guaranteed to win. And I was like, well, Jan.
No, that's not how it works.
Neither the Seahawks were, no. Nor the Patriots would have been one of those teams the previous year. And they just played each other in the Super Bowl. So it's a little bit like, I don't think you understand that, like, it's not guaranteed that one of the teams, this is in the NBA, that one of the teams with the best odds is going to win the Super Bowl.
Right.
Where are the Pistons? Were they, like, fairly low going to the season, or were they?
Yeah.
Okay, so they've been a pretty big spread, but they're also not probably going to win the championship.
Yes, the odds are still against them. One Seahawks departure in free agency in the past week, wide receiver Derek Young followed Clint Kubiak to the Raiders. So hope he gets an opportunity there.
Oh, it's kind of like Derek Young.
Super Bowl champion, Derek Young.
As with most of the players on the team. I think it's a fine strategy to pursue comp picks overall. I'm happy that John is finally doing it.
I mean, not finally. It's just like inconsistent from year to year. One year they'll do it. They're either all in or they're all out on comp picks.
I mean, they need more picks. Like that is what's going to keep this being sustainable as some of these players are getting those contracts. The players who won in the Super Bowl are going to become very expensive. And what is going to keep the roster sustainable is more draft picks. So this very next season, I think it may hurt them a little bit, but it is sort of building a team not for next season. It's building them for the quarterback after Sam Darnold.
I don't know how I would necessarily say that. But, you know, Jay, I think part of the reason they are willing to, you know, to your point, I don't know that the team is necessarily exceptionally young. It was young, but it wasn't exceptionally young. But the most important players on the Seahawks are JSN and Devin Witherspoon, who are still quite young. And, you know, last year's two rookies are way high up there as well. So from that standpoint, I do think having some patience makes sense for them.
Yeah. I mean, there are some older players that they, like, Darnold's not extraordinarily young, and Leonard Williams, DeMarcus Lawrence, those two. But, like, still, when you look at, like, cornerstone, we talked about this last week, Charles Cross is still quite young. Where it's like, those are your cornerstones, Devin Witherspoon, Charles Cross, JSN, and Byron Murphy. It's kind of like, and Iman Ori. Like, those are all very young players. And you could see them kind of stepping into those roles with the next Leonard Williams and the next DeMarcus Lawrence.
Yep. Sounds about right.
So, I mean, I think the team's set up pretty nicely overall, but I still am a little bit unsure of what the strategy is running back-wise, and I know that the team is going to run the ball a lot.
Yep. We're going to find out more on that one.
All right. Well,
on that
we already did the post-pod talk during the middle of the pod.
Yeah, nothing more to add.
You'll post those NCAA tournament pools. If there's anybody out there who doesn't have a Pelton Cast Talking Taco Time shirt, we've still got some, so happy to give one of those away.
If you're one of the correct sizes.
Yeah, I think I have most sizes.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't know.
That'd be good.
Yeah,
stay tuned for those. And thanks
for I wanted to make a Pelton Cast insignia shirt, like a college shirt. You didn't seem to like that very much, though.
Yeah, didn't do it for me.
It didn't do it for you?
No.
What should we do then? What merch?
None? I don't know.
I think college branding is very good.
Is it?
You don't agree with that?
I don't know.
There's
that
some
I do.
That's terrible, but I like the classic, like, old school insignia. I like the ones that just have like Wisconsin. You know what I mean? Just like an arch of that, something like that. You don't buy it? You want MLB hats with like 45 things on them?
Yes, that's definitely what I want.
A snake for some reason?
That is precisely what I want.
All right. Well, we'll probably do nothing.
Sounds about right.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Another classic.